from the mouse-infested studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another minty fresh episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Will planting mint deter miserable mises? On today's show, we'll reveal the surprising answer and put another stake in the heart of those miserable mothballs. Otherwise, it's a fabulous phone call show. Yeah, we're going to take that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and effusively elongated enunciations. So keep your ears right here. It's all coming up faster than you not finding those nasty little pellets in your pantry.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now for this week's edition of In the News. We report today on the good works of the Environmental Working Group, who tests supermarket produce for pesticides and issue an annual report in which they name that year's, quote, dirty dozen. Here are their findings for this year. Claiming the number one spot is spinach. This is, however, the time for you to plant your own spinach in just about any climate. Now, let us get on, shall we? Actually, lettuce is not on the list, but kale, collard greens, and mustard greens are right behind spinach for heavy pesticide contamination at a combined number two. And of course, this is also the correct time to plant their seeds outdoors in most locations. It's also the time of year to plant strawberry starts and seeds, an otherwise lovable fruit that unfortunately lands at number three on our non-hit chart. Now, there's two basic types. June berries are just that, big berries that produce a bumper crop in June in most areas. I much prefer the ever-bearing types. They produce much more naturally sized fruits all season long, and their flavor is superior to the Juneberry types. Next up is our grapes, which show up as number four on the Environmental Working Group's release. Research varieties that do well in your area before planting any rootstock grasshopper. Coming in at number five are nectarines, with the incredibly difficult to grow but tasty as all get out peaches right behind it, number six. Research carefully before you buy any fruit trees. Check your state's extension service for varieties recommended for your region, and don't fall in love with something on sale at a big box store. Cherries take the number seven spot. Fairly easy to grow. Be prepared to fight the birds for every single fruit. Very difficult to grow. Apples come in at number eight. Again, research your state extension to learn the best varieties for your area if you want to have a fighting chance. Blackberries come in at number nine. Pretty easy to grow. Most varieties have killer thorns, so seek out one of the thornless types. And all blackberries will spread in a most invasive manner, so don't say I didn't warn you. Next up at number 10 are pears, which are probably the easiest fruit tree for a home gardener. Potatoes at number 11 are equally easy to grow and highly recommended. Plant certified organic seed potatoes when your soil is 50 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 inches down. Note, the temps in the ocean and the bay nearest you will be similar, if not exactly the same. Blueberries finish up the list at number 12. Easy to grow if you provide highly acidic soil and fight the birds. And finally, the Environmental Working Group reports that over 60% of the samples contained, quote, forever chemicals, which are highly persistent and difficult to remove. I urge you to seek out the Environmental Working Group site to see their judging protocol and lots of other information and neat stuff. In the meantime, plant spinach and potatoes, because I said so.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, mice are an annoying problem. But how do you really keep them out? We're going to reveal that after lots more of your fabulous phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Paula, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Paula. How are you doing?
I am doing great here in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, it's always fabulous to hear from our listeners there. You have a very devoted gardening community in Nashville. It's a real, you ready for it? It's a real hotbed. Oh, thank you. Yeah, she actually said ha-ha. She couldn't. It's like a word balloon in a comic strip. Ha-ha. Thank you.
And you're welcome.
Okay, so we've established that you're a wonderful person. You live in Nashville. What can we do you for?
Well, I would love to be able to compost my food scraps, keep them out of the landfill, and use the compost on my houseplants. But I live in a condo with only balcony access to the outdoors. And so a compost bin or a worm bin really aren't good options for me. So I'd appreciate your thoughts on alternatives that might work for my circumstances.
Okay, so why do you rule out worm bins?
Well, I don't really have a good place. I don't know that the homeowners association would be thrilled with my having a worm bin.
Are you going to tell them?
People have a way of finding out things, you know.
Anyway, I just
don't know that I want to have a worm bin in my house, honestly.
But in general, it's always better to ask forgiveness than permission.
Well, that's true. But I also don't want to not be able to leave my home, you know, to travel and be worried about the worms and so forth. So I was really hoping to be able to put the food scraps maybe in something on my balcony and make sure the odor doesn't become a problem and just be able to do something different than a worm bin or, of course, one of those huge bins.
Well, this is a perfect time of year to remind people that we don't actually compost our food scraps. The majority of a typical compost pile is dry browns, especially shredded fall leaves, shredded dried corn stalks, straw, which means the seed heads have been cut off. That's the material, the bulk, that becomes compost. The food scraps we mix in provide food for the microorganisms that are already on, let's say, shredded leaves, and together they make compost. But it's the bulk material that's absolutely necessary. A lot of people want to start composting in the spring. It's obvious. And they buy a composter and they fill it with food scraps and they think they're doing great. And then about 2 months in, they go out with a load and look inside and go, oh, this has not become compost. It has become something I do not want on my property, because food scraps alone can't be composted alone. There's all sorts of devices and mechanisms you can use where you add like condensed pellets to make up for the lack of dry browns, but that's ridiculous. I'll tell you what your choices are. And they have increased greatly in the past, I'm going to say even 5 years, this thing has exploded. But there are now countertop composters that just utilize food waste. And okay, their boxes, I'm trying to decide, you know, maybe two toasters stacked on top of each other, that'd be the right kind of size. Inside is a bucket, and you fill the bucket with your food scraps as you go along. No meat, no bones, no citrus, really no bread or pasta or stuff like that. There's a way to get rid of that sustainably too. But you fill this with true wet greens, eggshells, coffee grounds, and of course, neither of those are green. That's why I started with them. Lettuce leaves, apple cores, broccoli stalks, cauliflower stalks, anything like that. You know, vegetable matter, plus the two outsiders are eggshells, which contribute tons of calcium, and coffee grounds, which you can't go overboard with in a small system like this, but they contribute a lot of nitrogen. And you essentially, the finished material is equal to worm castings. So what you do, you fill this thing up. Every day you put it back into the machine, which has a locking lid and a charcoal filter. So even if it takes you like a week to fill up the bucket, you won't get any smell, except, you know, for like 30 seconds when you're putting the fresh stuff in. So when the bucket is full, you turn the machine on and it slowly, basically overnight, stirs and heats the material automatically for you. And when it's done, it'll ding or the light colors will change. You have super soil that you can then add to your house plants. And if you eat a lot of vegetables and stuff, give it away to your friends. If you have plantings in front of your place that you have any kind of control over, you can spread it around them. Hey, even if you don't have any control, spread it when nobody's looking to counteract what the lawn care people are doing. Now, these machines are kind of expensive. Last time I checked, it was around $300. But as I say about a lot of things, you're going to amortize this. These things are built like tanks, and they will last for many, many years.
the company Vitamix makes one of them, and I have one of their super-powered blenders I got in the early 90s, and that thing works and looks brand new. They came out with the first one. I think it's called the Food Recycler. But shortly after that, other companies came out with them. You know, one of the nice things about Amazon is you can pull them up. You can try to figure out which reviews are real, which is getting harder all the time, and compare them for pricing and reviews. And that should solve your problem. If you don't want to throw away old bread or pasta or cake or anything like that, yeah, but see, but you'd get busted because it's a above ground device called a green cone. You dig out a little ditch, you put the cone on top of it, you throw the rest of your food waste in there, and it slowly, naturally enters the soil. Not to feed anything necessarily, but to not throw it in the trash.
Okay.
Has your head exploded yet?
No, I really appreciate the information. That's great.
But I also urge people who have the room that worm bins do this for at least one third of the price. They do not smell, because when you add garbage to a worm bin, you cover it with shredded newspaper. That's the only two contents, is the same kind of kitchen waste I just described and shredded newsprint. And I have left my worms alone, you know, feeding them first, making sure the moisture was right, for a month or more. And they do just fine. They're worms. They're eating food. You know, they're moving around. They're playing cards. They don't need you.
Okay.
But the choice is yours. And I think, based on the way you've described your situation, I think one of these on-the-counter food recyclers is perfect for you.
Okay. Well, that's great. Again, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And anytime I answer a question like this, I'm getting the word out to so many other people. These things are not well known, so I'm really happy to talk about them and let people know they're out there, and I have one, and it works really well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you for listening and calling and pretending to laugh at my jokes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Paula. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am on track to appear at the Allentown Public Library on Monday, April 27th at 6 p.m. Visit allentownpl.org/events. And you'll find Mike McGrath there and all the details on how to pre-register for this free event. And then come right back to hear the right ways to deter miserable Mises, Mises, Moses, Moses, Moses. And we'll take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I don't care if you live in the city, the country, they'll probably follow us to the moon. Mice are an annoying problem in the home. But how do you really keep them out? We're going to reveal that after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Now follow those prompts, and if we don't pick up, leave us a message.
My name is Candace. I'm calling from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I love the tips on how to do gardening with chronic health concerns. I did have a spinal fusion, so I am considering doing container gardens. But if I decide to plant the garden in the ground, what are some ways that I can protect my back? I had a pretty extensive surgery. Also, what can I use as a barrier to prevent my brother from running over the garden with the lawnmower? He swears he's never going to do it. Mistakes do happen, so I'm a little concerned about that. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Candace. And I'm going to address your brother before I get to the real topic. There's no way you can accidentally run over a garden. There's some family therapy needed here. So if he has an old gas-powered mower, when he's not around, take out the spark plug. If he has one of the new rechargeable ones, hide the batteries. If he has a corded, remove the cord. And when he goes, hey, what's going on? You say, you're not going on. I will destroy your lawnmower if you touch my garden again. It's really easy to tell the difference between turf grass and tomatoes. I don't know what's going on in the background here, but put your foot down, but put it down gently and lightly because you acknowledge that you have a very dicey back right now, which is great. 90% of success in this is people who acknowledge their limitations, do things differently, and everybody out there knows you don't want to mess up back surgery. I can't guess your age, but as I have gotten older, I have turned to a style of gardening that I quote unquote invented when I helped build a garden exclusively for the handicapped, everybody pretty much in wheelchairs. And it was very simple. There's a little investment up front, and then you're good to go. Tabletop gardening. Picnic tables, those white plastic tables, any sturdy flat surface that is high enough that you can reach what you want to do, like picking peppers or something like that, is the right height. There's no rules here. And essentially, if you have enough room, not on the lawn, and you have sunny spots on patios or something like that, that's the best way. Because, you know, if you do wind up in a wheelchair, even temporarily, you're not dependent on other people. So again, easy peasy. Most plants in the garden are fairly normal size. I love growing peppers. I love growing herbs. I'm trying to think of another thing that's too tall. All I can come up with is tomatoes and the dwarf varieties that have emerged in the last few years are absolute dynamite. They produce full-size tomatoes on plants that top out at like 3 feet. So no bending. Matter of fact, right? Isn't that one of my top garden rules? Bending is for chumps. Even people with good backs shouldn't be bending over, especially after that certain age. So get a high quality organic potting soil. Arrange your pots. If you've been gardening for years, I know you got a backyard full of pots like I do. Fill them with an organic seed starting mix and compost. You know, 50-50, whatever. If there's a lot of perlite already in the seed starting mix, you don't have to add any. But if there aren't a lot of those little white balls, invest in a bag of perlite, because the perfect container mix would be, you know, essentially 40% seed starting mix, potting soil, organic, 40% compost, and then the rest, some perlite. What looks like little styrofoam balls in the nursery is actually a mined mineral that lightens up the soil, keeps it from getting bogged down, retains moisture for dry times, but drains incredibly during rainy time. And then you arrange these on your picnic tables. That's what I use. They are heavy, however, so probably going to need some help setting them up. But once they are set up, the first thing you do is plant your pots around all the edges. The bigger the pot, the happier the plants are going to be. And that way you won't be wasting space in the middle. No, please don't try to grow a full-size tomato in the middle. You don't have 12 or 14 feet to play around with here. But it is just that simple. You get to pick the right spot, which should be facing south, southeast. Make sure you can maneuver, because it sounds like you're still on foot, but you are correct not to bend. Bending is for chumps. And, you know, keep them watered. You can feed them halfway through the season with a dilute solution of organic liquid fertilizer, but if there's enough compost in there and it's good quality compost, you don't need to. And now I defy your brother to mow that garden. All right, we got an email from a lady named Jane. Did the Rolling Stones sing that? And she can't be on the show vocally, so our peerless producer, James Ziprote, will read her email. And God bless James for attempting to pronounce this rose variety correctly. Take it away, James.
Jane writes, "Hello, Mike. I enjoy your radio show Sunday mornings here in Ohio. It is fun and informative. Thanks for supporting us organic gardeners. I hope you can advise me about my roses. Last spring, I planted two Zephyrine Druann rose bushes. Both were late installations due to nonstop rain. They did not bloom. One grew madly, but only had one bloom. The other went in even later, but did not ever bloom and stayed small. The difference could be the big one was bare-rooted, which I soaked 2 days. The second shrimpy one came in soil ready to plant. There was a huge amount of continuing rain. For this reason, I hesitated to try to train them on a support and could not figure out if an arbor or two trellises would work best. They are on a west-facing brick and stone wall that gets plenty of afternoon sunlight and is raised a bit and somewhat sloped away from the wall. The spot can be windy, and we had a very cold, icy, snowy winter here in Cincinnati. I laid the abundant canes of the first bush down as wind protection and had porous green landscape cloth on them secured with landscape staples. They looked good but had some brown and crossing canes that I pruned today. I opened them up because it warmed up here and the ground was warm and beginning buds appeared. Also, deer have been nearby and may have eaten buds. I interplanted successfully Mediterranean herbs, striving for organic deer repellent. There are a few sunny spots on my property, and this type of rose is somewhat shade tolerant, but no blooms makes me wonder if they should be moved. I am afraid I do not have a good spot, even on the north side of the house, where they might get morning sun. Is there anything I can do to give these bushes a better chance? I did resort to a couple applications of organic deer repellent in case the deer were the culprits. My other roses in a morning sunlit small area in the northern front of the house did bloom well. However, I now see deer prints in that bed despite the lavender, nepeta, and herbs surrounding them. Thanks for reading this and any advice you may have for me. Best regards, Jane.
Well, Jane, thank you very much for such a complete email. Normally, this would be difficult for me to figure out, but you answered every question I had before I could even ask it. They get plenty of afternoon sunlight. Ding, ding, ding. Roses, one of the most disease prevalent plants in our garden, don't care about the afternoon. They want morning sun to dry off any overnight dew, because if they stay cold and wet until the afternoon arrives, they're not going to live. So the spot can be windy. If they were in the sun in a better location, they might not be bothered by the wind. Wind is typically not a big problem for roses. I think the, quote, abundant canes of the first bush were the result of the plant struggling to get some sun, just as when our tomato starts don't get enough light, they become tall and skinny, which may be good for people, but is terrible for plants. It uses up all their energy in trying to get to that light that must be up there somewhere. And instead, they just grow tall and have a tremendous lack of energy from all that output. You prune them in the spring, because you say today, opened them up because it warmed up here and the ground was warm and beginning buds appeared. Okay, mistake number two. You do not prune when it's a warm day. You risk getting the rose alive again. You wake them up, they start sending sap up through the canes. And then without a doubt, especially, where's this, Cincinnati, I believe, they're gonna freeze. They're gonna freeze. If your weather was like mine, might have gone down to like 9 degrees after you pruned during a warm spell. Don't do that anyone. You want to just let the rose alone until all chance of frost has gone. That doesn't mean freezing cold. That means frost. There's nothing wrong with waiting to mid-April to prune your roses, because then they'll be actively growing and you can see what you're doing to remove old dead parts and open up the center for good airflow. But the knockout punch, there are a few sunny spots on my property. I'm afraid I do not have a good spot even on the north side of my house, where they might get morning sun. Okay, so you bought the Adams family old house, where it's sunny on the north, not in the south. They are essentially, I'm sorry to say this, but they're essentially being tortured. They are planted in the wrong spot. this might be a good example of someone fell in love with a plant in a catalog, or they saw in a botanic garden. They take it home, never thinking about whether they had a home that it would enjoy when you get there. At this point, I think it's perfectly safe to move them. But if you can't give them morning sun, and I mean sun from as soon as the sun comes up till at least noon, preferably two, they're going to be really unhappy. And the Red Cross is going to show up with chocolate and blankets for them. You can't repel deer with planted herbs surrounding them. No plant in the ground or in a pot will do anything to repel any garden pest. We could do a whole thing on deer control, and we probably will in the next couple of weeks. And I'm sorry, but my advice is to dig them up now that the weather is changing for the better. Roses move very easily, by the way. Taking a rose out of one spot and putting it in another is like bringing a child into the home after Thanksgiving dinner at 2 a.m. You can bang their little heads against a wall. They ain't going to wake up. But really, if you want to enjoy these roses, gift them to a neighbor who has morning sun and lots of it. Sorry, Jane, but that be the truth. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and re-announce that I will make a rare personal appearance at the Allentown Public Library on Monday, April 27th, at 6 p.m. Visit allentownpl.org/events for all the details and to register for this free event. Then we'll be right back with the correct ways to deter Mises from munching on your morsels and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Tired of your roses being ravaged? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal how to get the jump on Japanese beetles and their nefarious lawn grubs, plus your fabulous phone calls, and who knows what else. That's almost certainly on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you how to actually use an herbal substance that works to keep mice from leaving those little presents in your drawers and cabinets. But first, something completely different. We have uncovered tapes of my original shows going back to the turn of the century. And we've been scanning through them, and there's some great phone calls in there that you guys have not heard in a long time. And if you're like me and you heard it, you forgot about it. So join us in this trip down memory lane.
Forrest, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Forrest, how are you?
Oh, wet right now. It's raining cats and dogs here.
Where are you, man?
Northwest Florida.
Oh, okay. What's the name of the area?
Cottondale.
And what can we do for you?
I just wanted to to elaborate a little bit on a caller from last week's show. A guy from Enterprise, Alabama called. He had a problem with nematodes in his garden.
Right, the southern root knot nematode.
Right, right. It was giving him a fit with his cucumbers.
Yes.
And you made a suggestion to him about marigolds.
Correct, and he was doing the Elbon rye cure, plowing that into the soil to make it nematode resistant.
Right, right. I didn't realize that the marigolds was a good suppressant of the nematode, but that sounds pretty good. I've got some other suggestions also. Velvet bean is one thing. The wiregrass experiment station there in Headland, Alabama's done a lot of research on nematodes and biological controls of nematodes.
Right, and so is the velvet bean something you grow out and plow into the soil as well?
Right, right. You can use it as a manure crop, or you can harvest the beans. You know, there's not a real big market for the beans, but they can be harvested and fed for livestock.
I would think that the beans, these are nitrogen-fixing beans, right?
Right, it's a legume.
So this would be an exceptional green manure. Of all the three things we've talked about, this would actually be the most nutritional benefit to the soil to plow it under.
Right, and from what I understand with the velvet bean, you know, it's a summer crop. You don't have to leave it the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
You can plant it and let the plant mature, but not seed all the way out, not let the seed pods mature,
mm-hmm.
and till it in, and then plant a second crop in the same summer, so he could follow his cucumbers with it in the same year.
And that's helpful too, because if you plowed under fully developed plants, you'd probably be growing velvet bean there, whether you liked it or not.
Right, right. It is a hard seed, a real hard seed that could become a nuisance in later years.
Now, have you done this yourself, Forrest?
No, I have. I haven't used velvet bean. I have used Bahia grass and sesame.
I can't believe you said sesame, Forrest. You are talking to the only Yankee, probably, who ever grew sesame in his garden. I have grown sesame.
Let me ask you something. How did you get the seed? Did you go to Hardee's and buy a bunch of hamburgers and scrape the seed off the buns?
I swear that this happened to me, Forrest. You're not going to believe it. It happened once in my 30 years of gardening and never again. It was my first garden. But my wife and I went down to this local nursery where we lived in Pennsylvania, and we bought a couple of different six-packs of tomatoes, and we bought a couple of different six-packs of peppers and cucumbers, and we look, and there's this one bench that just has one six-pack left on it. And my wife felt sorry for it. It was like a little dog at the pound or something.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, go get that and grow that. And we didn't even look at the tag. We just picked it up. It was a stray. It followed us home. We get it home. It's a six-pack of sesame plants. And they absolutely thrived. And they were, it's a little bit like flax, if you've ever grown flax.
Never grown it, but I know what you're talking about.
And it was a lot of fun to grow. They got really tall. As I seem to remember, the aphids kind of liked them, but I just sprayed them out with the water from the hose.
Uh-huh.
And it was wonderful until we harvested them, and we were able to thresh the seeds out pretty easily, just beating the heads against a barrel kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But then when we tried to press some sesame oil from the seeds, it got really ugly.
Yeah, I plant sesame and plant it for birds. Let it mature out, and it'll get six, 7 foot tall, and then go in there and mow it down.
Yeah.
And seed everywhere. It's real prolific.
You know, it seems like when I was at Organic Gardening, the big plant was marigolds.
Uh-huh.
That was the research from one of the extension universities down south that they had found, especially the more potent the marigold. You know, marigold's a very smelly flower.
Uh-huh.
The more potent the marigold, the more years that soil would be very nematode resistant.
Really?
Yeah.
Another thing I was going to mention also, the castor bean is a good nematicide, but there's nothing you can do with it. It's, you know, it's highly toxic.
Yeah, but it's very dramatic. Your fields will look good while you're growing it out. But it seems like there are a great number of plants. And believe me, I realized long before we had all these wonderful listeners down south, I realized how serious a problem root knot nematodes are for southern growers.
Yeah, it's a real impact on the, you know, on agriculture down here.
But it sounds like there's a lot of cures, and especially, as I don't need to tell you, you burn up organic matter in your soil down there at the top of Florida, you're probably burning it up at least twice as fast as I am, maybe three times.
Right.
So this kind of green manuring, plowing these crops back into your soil, makes triple sense for you guys.
Right.
All right, well, that's fabulous stuff, Forrest. So what do you use mostly?
Bahair grass.
Bahair, and does that work well for you, too?
Works good. It's a longer-term rotation.
Okay. Well, I have a feeling if you plowed me into the soil, nematodes would stay away. And you get a lot of nitrogen, too. I'm full of it.
Right.
All right, Forrest, that's great. Thank you very much for contributing.
Hey, I really enjoy your show.
Oh, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too.
As always, it is now time for the question of the week, which we are calling Of Mice and Mint and Mothballs. James in Oklahoma City titles his email Mint versus Mighty Mouse and His Friends and Family, and writes, is there any scientific basis to show that planting mint around your house will repel mice and other rodents? The short answer is no. The long answer is that it appears that mint used in a different way really will keep mice from eating your unprotected edibles and building bedrooms in infrequently used kitchen drawers. As far as I can research, there is absolutely no proof that any plant will keep insects and or vermin out of a desired area when they're just sitting there on the ground or a pot. Yeah, if you plant nothing but strongly scented mints, there probably wouldn't be any mice in there. But that's very different than protecting a house. To do that, you would essentially have to dig a raised bed around the entire place and plant it with mint, which sounds like too much trouble to protect your supply of Triscuits. And within a few years, your entire neighborhood would be overwhelmed with mint, and then the mice would no longer be your primary problem. Note, any plant in the mint family, which includes plants without mint in their name, like lemon balm, is difficult to impossible to control once planted. Mints are wonderful plants, but they are aggressive, invasive, and harder to kill than Mickey's broomstick in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Back to mice, neither Mighty nor Mickey. I didn't want to rely on my, quote, old research here, so I did a fair amount of new searching around and found an excellent YouTube site called Mouse Trap Monday, wherein a guy named Sean Woods is testing everything that people say will repel mice. And these are not, quote, just YouTube videos. These are citizen science at its highest level, and are also fun to watch. One of the touches that impressed me the most were the things he tested that didn't work. Irish Spring. The mice actually ate the horrifically scented soap. The dreaded Carolina Reaper Pepper. The mice enjoyed eating that as well. Dryer sheets, predator urines, all were a bust. See, you can't fault Sean for being doubtful about peppermint oil. But after seeing his excellent science, I bought a commercial product from Victor, the world's leading producer of mouse and rat traps. It's chiclet-shaped little squares filled with essential oil of peppermint. Spoiler alert, they worked. For his experiments, Sean used a specially constructed drawer placed out in a barn. And like all good scientists, he had two drawers, one containing the supposedly active substance being tested and one that was baited without the supposed repellent. Both drawers had one tiny entrance hole that would allow mice to enter and leave, and both, as per previous experiments, were baited with sunflower seeds, a favorite food of miserable Mises. The package he purchased had two mint-releasing egg-shaped capsules, which he hung at opposite ends of the test drawer, poured some seeds into the drawer, and shut it normally. In what I'll call the control drawer, he just dropped in the seeds and slid the drawer into place. And both brilliantly and seriously creepy, he had night vision cameras set up to capture the action. The footage shows mice coming into the drawer with the mint-releasing devices and exiting faster than a vampire in a crucifix factory, while every seed in the control drawer was dined upon with fervor. I am therefore convinced that essential oil of mint placed in the drawers and pantries in which you would normally find evidence of mouse invasion is a great idea. And yes, you can grow peppermint yourself and use the leaves crushed up to release their scent. Just be sure and contain the spread of the actual plants and replace the repellent every 30 days or so. More importantly to me, Sean also provided concrete evidence of the ineffectiveness of a popular but highly dangerous, quote, home remedy, mothballs. He spends the first minute of this video explaining the serious toxicity of these little cancer grenades and warns that it is a violation of federal law to use mothballs against mice. And he proved that they do not work. That experiment, same two drawers. He first put one mothball into the corner of the true drawer. The mice enter and gorge themselves on the seeds. He tries again, this time using the entire package of mothballs. And he cheats in favor of the mothballs by putting a hard plastic cover on top to concentrate the fumes. You and I would run out of this death trap immediately, but the mice are undeterred, eating every seed. This reinforces what I've been saying about mothballs for untold decades. Do not use them. They are more toxic to you than your intended target. Note, the original version of this story appeared some 7 years ago, so products and such may have changed names, but the truth remains the same, especially the plea, don't buy mothballs. Well, that sure was some good information about deterring miserable mices. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure, or of course your leisure, by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my peppermint if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. You can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're a wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Come on, people, please include your location. You'll find all of our contact information, plus answers to your garden questions. and links to our internationally renowned podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is an hour-long public radio show and podcast, all produced and delivered to you, not weekly, but strongly, by NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he fell asleep in Dulcimer Grove and woke up 100 years later to a world with greatly improved plumbing. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Zipro. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll keep myself busy planting peas and lettuces and super cool potatoes until I see you again next week.